day, and welcome to Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree. I'm Nicholas Lorimer with my esteemed co-host here, Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel.
Nicholas is talking nonsense. It's the morning, which is why there was that awkward pause.
Well, I said good day because I don't know what time they're listening to this podcast, right?
Right.
So, you know, it could be at 2 o'clock in the morning, could be at 6 o'clock in the morning. We don't know.
We don't know. But what we do know, and what we should fully disclose at the start of this, is that it's Christmas morning here in the IRR's offices.
Christmas party day.
And so we've popped a couple of Grolsches.
Yep.
Best Dutch beer that you can get here with that bottle top that flips open. And cheers, Nick.
Cheers. And one of my favorite political writers in the US, Jonah Goldberg, he always says that you can't say you've been drinking all day if you don't start in the morning.
Yep. Classic old American tradition. And I think part of the idea is that today's a nice day to get wrecked.
Yes.
We're going to go have a braai at one of our colleagues' places, Duval. Yes. He has hosted some of the greatest sort of fringe English and Afrikaner rock bands at his place. He's got a big back garden with lots of chickens and rabbits and marijuana plants and braai stands and all kinds of things. And so we're gonna have a Christmas braai and hand out presents to each other. We've got a Secret Santa vibe going, and we won't really get wrecked. Wrecked is R-E-K-T.
Which is a thing that the youth of a few years ago used. It's a misspelling of the word wrecked, as in shipwrecked.
Yeah.
And basically it means destroyed.
Yeah.
And, you know, this all being said,
we can be more or less playful. And yeah. So we're gonna get playfully wrecked, but we thought that we'd look back on 2019 and see the things that have been more or less playfully wrecked.
Yes. So we have a whole list, and the challenge today is to not get caught on any of them, as we have a tendency to do.
Yeah. We last week, so that you know, we were supposed to hit four topics, and we covered exactly three quarters of one topic.
Three quarters of one topic, and it was a long, crazy, rambling discussion as well. As I'm sure you know, those of you who listened to us and suffered through that. So thank you very much for suffering through that.
Yeah.
But we promised to make it up to you this time.
Less political theory, more facts on the ground.
More facts on the ground. So the first thing that got wrecked was Hong Kong or China, depending on how you look at it.
Wrecked.
Because Hong Kong, the people of it, have been very upset with their extradition bill. But their protest that the mainland introduced, and this would have allowed the mainland of China to basically take people out of political dissidents.
That would it would have turned the political system, the criminal justice system of Hong Kong, into
an
outsourced branch of China's mainland criminal justice system. Exactly. And people who are serious about looking at the invisible strands that weave through a society and bind it together under a thing sometimes called the rule of law.
Yes.
When it's really rules that are dictating the game, or sometimes it's called arbitrary power when it's really a kind of, you know, big man boss who gets to decide who goes into Tricky and who gets to run around free.
Yep.
And the Hong Kongese were not super stoked on having their criminal justice system become an outsourced branch of the Chinese Comintern.
And that extradition bill has been withdrawn. But the problem, of course, is that now there is far more at stake.
Yeah.
A lot of the protest has turned into a protest against police brutality.
Yeah.
And there's ongoing clashes between protesters, which are still quite large, the number of protesters, and the Hong Kong police, who have gone from a generally well-respected institution to one that is relatively unpopular. And this has culminated recently in the defeat in the local government elections in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is unique in China that it's one of the few places that actually holds elections. The pro-government, the pro-Beijing candidates were smashed.
Yeah. It's like a 60-point swing. Eh? They had like a 60% majority, 7% majority.
In terms of seats, in terms of actual votes, it wasn't as dramatic.
Yeah.
But it was still pretty big. And that was on the back of very high turnout.
Yeah.
And this is a bit of a stumbling block for the Chinese, because if you looked at the sort of Chinese state propaganda coming out, they very genuinely expected to win.
Yeah.
Convincingly, they'd set the Hong Kong protesters up. They call them rioters.
There were plenty of protesters that were violent, that were silly, that were making bizarre demands. But there was obviously enough real, I mean, I think there were genuine acts. Enough real real concerns that reasonable people might share, that the efforts to discredit the whole movement on the basis of its most radical fringes didn't really work out.
And a 73% turnout in an election, which is, I believe, approximately where the turnout was,
is huge.
It's very high for a local government election, especially.
Yeah.
So that is quite spectacular.
And I want to tell a quick story about that. So I've lived a year in Russia plus, and one of the interesting things that comes out of that is knowing various people who, you know, from a South African point of view, it looks like either you were for communism or against it. But when you're inside Russia, you can be like, no, we were for Leninism, or no, we were for Stalinism, or we really thought Gorbachev had it right. We thought Khrushchev had it right.
Brezhnev wasn't so bad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that Stalinists often have against Leninists, but then that people who like the communists that came after Stalin sort of also hold against Stalin a little bit, but really it goes against Lenin, is the idea that the reason that the Soviet Union collapsed was because it was made that way in the first place. And the metaphor that they use is the chocolate bar, the Cadbury's chocolate bar, the Nestle chocolate bar. It's got this sort of terrible, unctuous, sweet, weak, decadent flavor to it. And the whole idea is that a chocolate bar that you buy in the store is made to be broken up into pieces very easily. Mm. They're those divots, those seams, lines, yes, those seams carved into it. So it's very easy to break it off piece by piece.
And by having all the little socialist republics inside the USSR.
And that was a decision that came at a point in the 20s. They were like, okay, how are we going to set this up? Are we going to have a federation, or are we going to have it all really centralized under Moscow? And he's like, no, we're going to have a federal kind of idea of a system and let the Ukrainians have their thing and let the Poles have their thing, and Poles weren't involved yet, but let those Latvians Balkans in. And they, so they set it up so that you could break it off chunk by chunk. And as soon as the chunks started breaking off, it looked like they would break off, the whole thing just ended up collapsing.
Because, of course, the borders that were drawn in the Soviet period are still the borders of the countries around Russia.
Those seams are that's how the chocolate broke. Yeah. And so China's got a chocolatey problem too, in that Hong Kong is like a little break-offable piece. Mm. Macau is a little break-offable piece. Mm. Tibet is a little break-offable piece. A very big break-offable piece, but not with a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the Uyghuristan is kind of a break-offable piece.
And to a certain extent, Mongolia as well.
Once you start going, the pieces really start. So China's, Beijing's got this very real politic concern that any more concessions that they make to the Hong Kongese show how thin these seams are. And how a little bit of pull, and you can really break a piece off, and then that'll excite people around the other parts of it. And I think my theory is that Beijing would sort of gladly let Hong Kong go if it meant they could keep using it as a financial hub for Chinese elites to do business and so on. If they had like some metaphysical guarantee that none of the other pieces are going to break off.
Yeah, that's
just not going
to
happen.
There is also the fear that, as what's happened to Russia with Ukraine, where Ukraine wants to go west, the Chinese communists, the Chai Coms, would be very upset and think that maybe Hong Kong might suddenly allow U.S. aircraft carriers to park there if it was independent, which would freak them out very much. It's bad enough that American aircraft carriers can already do it in Taiwan.
Yep.
Which, depending on who you ask, is China rule, not China.
Yeah, yeah. So that's a piece. That's the case in point piece of, like, according to some people, it's already been broken off and eaten up by the West.
Yes. And, of course, the other thing that's really been smashed as part of this is China's soft power image. They've been doing a lot of work to build it up.
Yeah. And Belt and Road Initiative, trillions of dollars of commitments.
But simultaneously, two things have happened. One is the Hong Kong protests, and the other one is China's. Uyghuristan, their western province, where they have these big camps, which, according to all the sort of reporting and information coming out about them, are quite horrifying things.
Quite harsh. Nick thinks they're like the Gulag. I say until you've killed 10 million people, you're not like the Gulag, but they certainly aren't nice.
We don't know the numbers. And the documents from the Chinese Communist Party that the New York Times released showed the Communist Party officials saying, I think the direct quote is, show them no mercy.
It really doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. We will see. Unfortunately, there's very little the world appears to be able to do to stop such things beyond provoking some conflict that would be way more devastating.
Yeah.
So we have to see with how this develops.
Yeah.
Hopefully, there is a happy resolution, if such a thing is possible.
Next.
Yes. So Elon Musk.
Elon Musk's truck got wrecked.
Yes. So he developed this really bizarre looking truck, which, according to the official line, was based off of designs from Blade Runner. It's this very sort of sleek, weird, modern-looking thing. It
looks like a little bit like a triangle,
like a bit like
on top of a box. I find the design attractive. Part of the reason that it is designed that way is because it's made out of cold rolled steel. Whoever knows what that means. Basically, it's the same material they use to build rockets that they send into space and that can land on their own tails very impressively. And because it's such a hard, amazing metal, you can't press it into fancy shapes the ways that soft exteriors of most trucks are pressed. So it's got to be very angular. And they sort of,
talk about what's special about it is that it's an electric car.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be more powerful, basically, than any other pickup truck on the market.
Yeah. Excepting one of the things that's tricky about it is I don't understand how it's a pickup truck because it doesn't have an obviously open load bin at the back.
It does.
It's a triangle. It looks closed to me.
No, it's just sleek. It's got a thing, and it's got even a triangle like tailgate thing
that
comes down. It's a weird.
It's closed cabin thing. It's very weird. I think it looks super cool.
This is one of the wonderful things about eccentric, insane rich people.
Yeah, billionaires.
Billionaires is that they develop fascinating things.
Yeah,
and Elon Musk is continuing that noble tradition of eccentric lunatic.
Yeah.
With his space rockets and his weird electric cars. I mean, I don't know whether I'd buy one, but like the idea that there's cool futuristic cars driving around like this is
out there. Awesome. Yeah, dude, if I saw one of those rolling through the streets of Hillbrow, I would start playing Galagata. Hey, I'd be feeling very cool. Just to see it. If I was driving in it, I would feel so awesome.
That's a very early 2000s kind of cool though.
Yeah. Elon Musk, I feel his sense of cool comes from around the time TKZ and Mendoza and company were.
Yeah, maybe. The reason it got wrecked, though, was at their demonstration of the car.
It's terrible.
He decided that, you know, it's supposed to have these, like, completely shatterproof windows. And they were showing it off, you know. So they firstly had guys hit the thing with hammers, and it didn't make a dent. It was, like, brilliant. And then he was like, let's throw a big metal ball at the window and show you how the window is completely impervious to damage. And he did it, and the window smashed.
And then he's like, okay, maybe let's throw it at the other window. And then he threw it at that one, softer. And that one smashed too.
Yeah, so it has some bugs.
And then he had to do the rest of the presentation in front of that. By the way, I don't know if you've seen his explanation for why it smashed.
Oh, yeah?
So he said that what happened is when they did the sledgehammer thing against the door, that sledgehammering the door underneath the window didn't crack the window, but it fissured the connection between the window at the bottom, underneath where you can't see, and the sort of plane that's holding the window up. And so as soon as that fissured, that's what disrupts the crystal lattice of the metal.
This is why we have dress rehearsals, people.
And then they threw the thing, and then you get the shatter. So that's, I mean, whatever. It is what it is.
Yeah, maybe it's true. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. I don't always trust everything that Elon Musk says. He has a lot of excuses for things. But let's move on.
Yeah. Anyway, so his thing got wrecked.
Yes. So something delicious happened this year, which is that Rumbaforia, which we warned about,
wrecked.
I think that it's fairly safe to say that the Rumbaforia, or that sort of delusion about how Ramaphosa was going to be this great heroic reformer who was going to lead the ANC into a new century of a wonderful economic growth and social harmony and all these great things.
A thousand flowers would be allowed to bloom.
Exactly. Not so much.
Yeah, so this feels very personal to me in a way. I started my political career in journalism. My career in political journalism in 2017, sort of on the eve of the Nasrec election. I'd been an art critic till then, trying very hard to sort of look at the beautiful stuff that we have in this country, and that beauty is often horrific, and sometimes it's almost always surprising if it's real beauty, dangerous, sometimes very pleasing. And that came to be very hard for me. And then I found some interesting data about the fact that Ramaphosa was basically six times more popular than, of course, Zanda Dlamini Zuma amongst the ANC's voting, amongst people who had voted for the ANC before. And so it seemed crazy that they were going into the Nasrec election where these 5,000 delegates supposedly representing the ANC's base were half and half split between him and NDZ.
And of course, the delicious thing about the collapse of Ramaphosa is just all the ways that it has, especially on the economic front.
Hold on, let me finish my story. This is to say that Ramaphosa, or the hope that Ramaphosa would be a genuine reformer, was something before it was believed by the press. The press started believing it after he was elected at Nasrec. before he was elected at NASREC, the press was sort of quite skeptical about him and very willing to give NDZ a bit of a chance and be like, story she is that like...
She was the true face in a sense of rural South Africa or something like that.
Exactly. So they were confused. The first people to have Ramaphosa were ordinary ANC voters. And what was most interesting about the data that I saw, survey data, 5,000 respondents all visited twice, the biggest sort of single political survey in the new South Africa done... commissioned by ENCA, was that his preference for Ramaphosa was even stronger amongst poor, less educated, unemployed black people than it was amongst the middle class of black and white alike.
Do you hear that sound?
So,
that's a sound of narratives collapsing.
Yeah. So he really was beloved in the heartland. He was very fond in the urban centers. He was the most popular guy across race, class, gender, every kind of religion, all the divides that you can think of. And I think a big part of that was the same survey showed that people really wanted more business-friendly policies. One of the things they said is, do you want radical economic transformation? Do you want to continue with the status quo? Or do you want more business-friendly stuff? And I think a majority said more business-friendly. If you add in status quo and... more business friendly, that was like 85, nearly 90%. People who wanted radical economic transformation, which would most easily be exemplified by expropriation without compensation, were a tiny little portion at the top.
Yeah.
And so it looked like Ramaphosa really had all the makings of a real revolution because he had all the political capital, not just to be popular as an individual, not just to go after corruption, but also to come and deregulate, make it easier for businesses to get going, cut the red tape,
make the
cut
hard the kind choices, of B, fight the unions,
anti-meritocracy, fight the unions, all that kind of stuff. And instead of doing that, instead of listening to the people, it seems to me that what he did is listen to the media, which in 2018 got going with Ramaphosa and carried on pushing it through 2019. And that Ramaphosa wasn't about policy. It was just about this weird idea of patriotism, where to love the beloved leader and to hope is patriotic. Mm-hmm. It's a very weird thing that hope is patriotic. There's not a lot of countries of whom that's true. But it's certainly true of us. And that hope has started to erode. And there's lots of ways that we see it in terms of major captains of industry, foreign attachés.
Debt levels.
Who all last year, when we were saying, guys, look, we would love just as much, if not more than you would, for him to be the reformer that you believe him to be. But we're not seeing the evidence that we were hoping for. And we've already laid down dashboard markers for you to look at to see if he's really going for it. And so you've got to, we think you need to apply more pressure and then he'll do it because maybe his heart's in the right place. That's a hard thing to ever get a read on anyone, and he's particularly enigmatic.
Yeah.
But those dashboard markers are not coming up. And people would say to us repeatedly, you know, we think you're just being a bit sour, a bit negative. You know, things are going to work out.
Give him a chance. He's playing the long game.
Yeah. And this year, especially in the last couple of months, we've been hearing a lot of, we wish we'd listened to you sooner.
Yeah.
Coming from very serious and important power people. And
there's so many ways which is visible. The sort of the debt levels, all those bad ideas that were kicked around during the Zuma era being implemented, things like NHI, EWC.
My pet one is the national minimum wage, which was the core competency. Developing that policy was the core competency under the deputy president, then Cyril Ramaphosa. And we've now instituted a national minimum wage that's equal to the median wage, which is something that no country in the world has ever tried. Most countries that get it right have a minimum wage that's half the median wage. So if our minimum wage was 1,250 rand a month, which is what the government pays a lot of its workers, that'd be one thing. But instead we've got this crazy thing where you've got 55% youth unemployment, but kids and school system where 5 in 100 people who enter the public school come out with a matric pass in mathematics. And yet, if you don't have a matric pass, you know, if you're not one of the very lucky few who makes it into university, your only real chance of getting a job is going to be to go work for 1,500-2,000 rand a month and live on the bones of your ass until you manage to upskill and get your way into a better situation.
If you
and
manage.
People can't even get that foot in the door.
Yeah, yeah. And It's really not looking good out there, but we'll see. There's a long way to go. But I think we can say that
the stupid side of optimism has been wrecked.
The stupid side of optimism has been wrecked. There may be a happy ending to this story, but we first got to go down a lot more bumps in the road.
Yeah.
Before we can
potholes in the road. And I just want to add to that, Yeovil streets. Yeovil is a suburb just next to the center of Johannesburg. First suburb in which black people and white people were basically living together. Its streets got wrecked. I counted about 60 holes that had been dug by the municipality to completely redo the water system underneath. And some of it's been fixed.
And some of it is not. Well, hopefully the new mayor of Johannesburg will sort that out. Whoever that's going to be.
Joburg mayoralship got wrecked.
Yes, that's not on our list, but we don't know how that story ends yet.
We can't
really say what's going to happen.
No.
All right, so I've written here, Nork peace gets wrecked, and by Nork I mean North Korea. So Trump did this whole song and dance where he starts off talking to North Korea with the fire and fury, and he says, we're going to destroy you, wipe you out if you keep threatening us and you're so out of control. But the story has then it changed all of a sudden when Donald Trump decided to meet with Kim Jong-un, which apparently the North Koreans have been in favor of for a very long time. But yeah. Donald Trump is the first American president to actually say yes to it.
They go from hating each other to loving each other and literally writing love letters.
Trump has said that he's received lovely letters from Kim Jong-un,
mm-hmm.
Who is the jailer of millions of people in the world's largest open air prison camp, which is North Korea. Anyway, there were some promising early signs that maybe there was some potential peace offering.
Yeah, there was vials to stop nuclear to stop missile testing, to bulk the nuclear missile program.
But the U.S. Trump has even canceled some of the military drills with South Korea, and this is also it's not just a U.S. North Korea thing, because the South Korean government currently is very. To say pro-North Korean is a little bit perhaps of an exaggeration, but they are the left of South Korea, and they do have a strong affinity for North Korea. They have
they really want to rejoin.
I heard someone once describe the Korean War as not so much a war between nations as a war between right and left in Korea,
mm-hmm.
Which just happened to have a geographic structure to it.
Yeah.
So anyway, there were some promising early signs, but there were a lot of people who said things like, well, are the North Koreans for real, and are the Americans being played here?
And and against that, there were a lot of Trump's like fans who were like, give Donald Trump a Nobel Peace Prize right now
for solving the greatest, longest running conflict in human history. You know, not exactly, but that was the kind of sentiment. But there were some early warning signs. One of the secretaries of state went to North Korea to negotiate some of the more finer details of any kind of agreement.
Mm.
And the North Koreans got him to pay for the medical costs of an American who the North Koreans had taken prisoner and beaten to death in one of their prisons. And they got the Americans to pay for the medical costs of looking after
wiping them. The blood off the floor.
Yeah, pretty much. That was a bad early sign.
Humiliating.
The North Koreans kept stonewalling, didn't make many concessions, and as a result, the Americans made very few concessions. There was no real lifting of sanctions.
Rex Tillerson was still kind of running part of the show.
Yeah.
And he was very irritated
with
the North handied. Koreans.
Yes. And it seems now the final nail has been put in this coffin, because the North Koreans, I think, two, 3 days ago, launched two missiles from a new missile system.
Yeah.
Doing another test into the Eastern Sea.
Yeah. So sadly, peace there, wrecked.
And we'll see how that develops. It looks like it's just going to stay the status quo for a while.
Yeah.
North Korea is a very mysterious place because it's very closed. So we don't really know what's going on there.
Very difficult. I just want to add, I think maybe the best movie I've seen this year is called Parasite. It was made in South Korea. And it's kind of just a little family drama, but it touches on some very deep universal human condition things. And there's also a very obvious kind of parable being told about the North-South Korea relationship. And it's still going in Cinema Nouveau, in Rosebank, and around the country, wherever there are sort of art cinemas. And wherever there's the internet, you can always hack it offline.
Maybe I should actually watch it. I mean, I'm very lazy about watching good pieces of literature.
Yeah, I'm just plugging it. Dude, it's so easy. It starts out really funny, and then it becomes dark in a way that I think it's hard to become dark unless you live with a nuclear arsenal pointed at your head.
Yes, there's quite a lot of good cinema out there actually right now from Asia in particular. So a Japanese film about, I saw someone recommending it on the internet, about people who are making a film about zombies, but there's also zombies for real outside. I haven't watched, but it looked pretty good from the trailer.
Very meta.
All right, so we're gonna come back to that one because I think it requires a little bit more mulling about on. The Great Cathedral, built in, I think, the 900s. Notre Dame in Paris.
Notre Dame.
Got wrecked this year.
Yeah.
When it caught fire for, I don't think they know the reasons. I think they speculated it was, a welding tool or something.
Yeah,
Because it was being redone, restored, because it's a very old building. Caught fire, the roof burned off, but the inside seems to be mostly intact.
Yeah, the stained glass, the massive stained glass windows survived.
Yes.
Fantastically.
Which is very good.
Yeah.
It means that they'll probably be able to repair it in not too long.
Yeah.
But it was still a horrifying sight to see this wonderful, artistic, ancient building, you know, more than 1,000 years old, up in flames. Yeah. And it's a real symbol of Paris and France.
Yeah.
Also subject to all sorts of conspiracy theories about it being burned down on purpose by, you know, sort of Islamic extremists or something like that.
Yeah.
Which never went anywhere. There seems to be no real evidence of that.
Yeah.
But it was a great tragedy. So hopefully no more special buildings will get wrecked next year.
Yeah. No. Buildings are nice. It's nice.
Buildings are nice, especially very old ones.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite is the Hagia Sophia, which is the very big mosque/church/museum in Istanbul. Or Constantinople.
Yeah.
And it's... I hope that it remains as a museum. There have been some moves by Erdogan. There's some suggestions that he might turn it back into a mosque.
Yeah.
But it has it's a magnificent building. It has a very long history. So hopefully that survives. It's also survived a lot of earthquakes, and that part of the world is prone to them, so I hope there's not another one.
Political and geophysical.
Yes, yes, or both. So hopefully we don't lose any more of those nice structures next year. Here's another fun one. The Mueller report got wrecked.
Wrecked.
So for those of you who don't quite remember, because it was 400 million news cycles in America ago, seems like
in a galaxy far, far away.
On the edges of your mind, in the distant mists of your memory, there was this idea that there had been collusion between the Donald Trump's political campaign to be elected and... The Russians they basically colluded together to steal the election from Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
and Donald Trump kept saying nice things about Putin, and he fired an FBI director for looking into this, and so
Congress, and then hired Christopher Wray. Who did he fire again?
James Comey.
James Comey. Yeah,
and so
tall. I think he went to Princeton.
Like our esteemed colleague here, Gabriel Krause.
Yeah,
went to Princeton University. Just don't forget that he went to Princeton University.
Wrecked. Princeton will never get wrecked, I hope.
Oh, well.
Like the Hagia Sophia. Let it live 1,000 years.
Never's a very long time.
It does have bullet holes from... It was the capital of America during the Civil War. And so it had been shelled a little bit by the South.
Oh, that's interesting.
Didn't get wrecked, though. Just got semi-wrecked.
Excellent. So anyway, this Mueller report finally comes out. There's all the speculation. It's saying, oh, it's going to be devastating to Trump. It's going to absolutely destroy him. And it says that basically they couldn't find real evidence of collusion. There was an attempt, it seems, by the Trump campaign to do some sort of very low-key collusion, but they didn't actually get it together because they weren't very competent, it turns out.
They were dummies. And some of them had made money before the campaign.
Yes.
In super dodgy ways.
In super dodgy ways. And it got very complicated very quickly. But there was no phone call between Putin and Donald Trump where Putin said, you know...
You've been nice to me. Listen, I'll be very, very nice to you.
Exactly. Such a cartoonish, clean-cut thing didn't come out. And as a result, the whole thing fell a bit flat. There was still some damaging stuff in there for Trump. It turns out that he seems to have wanted to obstruct the investigation. Several times he ordered his subordinates to go and fire Mueller, which would have created a bit of a constitutional crisis because this is exactly what led to Richard Nixon basically being chucked out. He fired someone who was investigating him.
And then fired the deputy.
And then fired the deputy when they also refused to toe the line.
Yeah.
But his subordinates argued him out of it. They said, no, this is a terrible idea. And he never really pushed the matter.
Yeah.
He just kind of seems to have been venting. And so he didn't come out particularly well from the Mueller report, but he also didn't do anything particularly illegal.
Yeah. So one of the things that bugs me about this is that I really, yes, I'm not keen on corruption anywhere amongst anyone. And I'm very glad, like the Mueller report could have looked at through one eye. It's a great victory because Mueller's investigations really did lead to quite a few people being jailed, quite a few people being sort of knocked out of politics, political careers being ended. And that's such a good thing.
Yeah.
Good God. If we could have that here, wouldn't that be nice?
It would be nice, wouldn't it?
Quick, relatively quick and with some effect. One of the problems is that, you know, I loved the New York Times when I lived in America for 6 years and I used to read it every day. And one of the things that broke my heart about that most esteemed newspaper in the world until not so long ago is that a couple of days before the election, the little bar that it carried on its front page of who's going to win the election, its prediction bar.
Percentage chance was.
It was blue for Clinton, red for Trump. The blue was so big that there weren't enough pixels for there to be any red at all. They had Clinton on a 98% chance 2, 3, 4 days before the election. Then it came down to like 92%. So you could see a little bit of red. Yeah. And then they didn't really ever try to come to terms with how they'd managed to get it so wrong.
No.
And instead seemed to jump right into the Russiagate story, according to which the reason that anyone would have gotten it wrong was because Russia had interfered in the election. Yeah. And so you don't really... So figuring out how we got it wrong means
assuming
from the start that the Mueller report is going to show up Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin having a very intimate relationship that results in Vladimir Putin using all of the tentacles of the Russian octopus to inveagle its way into the American body politics.
So the story is basically that a lot of these media institutions basically said, no, no, we're not wrong. The election was wrong.
Yes. That's one point.
Which turns out to not really be the case.
Yeah. And then today or this week, The New Yorker, which I really rate as, you know, generally a fantastic magazine with beautiful long-form journalism and in-depth.
Yeah, it's famous kind of, for that. It's some really good stuff in there.
And they published some of the best, like, novelists and short story writers, and Hannah Arendt used to submit really brave journalism there way back in the day, sort of like nice historic little note. Anyway, they have been one of the very few major publications to go even a step further and say Christopher Steele, the guy who was hired by Fusion GPS, which was being paid by the Clinton Foundation.
Yes, to investigate claims about Trump's activities in Russia.
And they produced the idea that there was this P-tape and that was being used to blackmail Trump.
It was a very embarrassing, weird sexual thing going on that was being used to...
So
as it says in the Steele dossier, he himself, Christopher Steele, is like, I'm not sure about this one.
I ain't too sure about this. But so the thing is, like, most people have been like, okay, so this is a bit of a problem. But the New Yorker has been sort of running a very sympathetic line and being like, Steele, it's too easy to put Steele down.
Because some of the things he did say were true.
Yeah. But most not true. And then there's this thing about, like, if a spy is getting half the things right, does that mean he's a really good spy because it's hard to get anything right? Or does that mean he's a rubbish spy because he's been given chicken feed in order to get some credibility in order that bigger lies can be fed his way or he can feed bigger lies?
At the end of the day, that dossier was really just a collection of rumors.
Right.
Some of which were true.
Some of which literally came out of a bar in, like, Copenhagen. Anyway. One of here's what concerned me about this in this week's edition of The New Yorker, their most recent defense of it, because I think is that they say, here's a question you have to ask yourself: was Christopher Steele a useful idiot? Were some of those rumors deliberately planted by the Russians
to cause chaos
for the purpose of delegitimizing the Clinton campaign? By getting a Clinton-hired dude and a Clinton-hired firm to say crazy things about Trump to try and humiliate him so that if Trump were to lose, he could then complain and say this election was rigged because the Russians and the Clintons and all kinds of people have it out for me, and so they spread vicious lies about me, and that's what cost me the election.
And it does seem clear, just before we move completely off the Mueller thing, that... the Russians really were trying to mess around.
This is the question that The New Yorker asks, and the way that it answers by asking Christopher Steele himself. And he says there is no reason that the Russians had to want to do anything to hurt Trump. They only wanted Trump to win. They had no interest in anything else. And this is just demonstrably crazy. Russian bots have been shown to have been running Facebook campaigns for Black Lives Matter and against Black Lives Matter, for queer movements and against queer movements,
for the ultra left positions and for the ultra right positions.
Mm. The whole point of trying to, they weren't as interested. Look, as much as the New York Times was silly for thinking that Trump had a 0% chance of winning, even the smartest people like Nate Silver thought that he was less likely to win than not. It was less likely to
flip.
So it was much. So if you're a Russian bot or whatever agent, and you want to meddle in the election, you can't just hope to try and make Trump win. One of the things you've got to try and hope to do is make sure that if Hillary Clinton wins, she wins in the most hamstringing, nasty way possible.
Which would have
and
been
that would be exactly the kind of thing that would motivate you then to feed steal chicken feed. And instead of even acknowledging the possibility, he categorically denounces it.
Yeah.
And the New Yorker supports him in that categorical denouncement. And I think it's just irresponsible for them not to recognize that something that is much more threatening to American democracy than any particular candidate winning is for the whole environment to become so suspicious and cynical
and toxic
that it doesn't really matter who's winning, what because they're going to be hamstrung from beginning to end by impeachment procedures, by vicious, complete disallowance of the benefit of the doubt, and by political kneecapping start to finish.
I think what the Russians really wanted was an electoral college tie. So this is a theoretically possible position in the American...
This is not what the Russians really wanted. But you should tell people what an electoral college tie is.
No, come on. This would have been great for them.
I mean, it would have been a dream come true for certain mad people, including Nicholas Lorimer. So tell us more.
So basically what happens is there's a set of circumstances where... So normally you need 270 votes in the electoral college system in the US to win a presidential election. But it is possible for both sides to get 269. At which point, the election is removed completely from the Electoral College, and the House of Representatives chooses the president, and the Senate chooses the vice president, which means that you can end up with a candidate from one party being the president and another being the vice president. It's never happened before, and it would create serious problems because the losing side who wasn't picked would say that this was unfair. The Democrats, for example, in 2016, if they had lost this way, if Trump had become president because the Republicans had voted him in the House, would have said something along the lines of, it's just because the Republicans gerrymandered all the districts, and so it wasn't a fair election, and it's all fake news and lies.
But now they have the House, so if it were to happen in 2020, it would be on the other foot, and it would be the Republicans saying...
And it would be... It would be a disaster. Twitter would be amazing on the day it happened.
Yeah.
Because there would be so much fighting.
American democracy would be wrecked.
Would be wrecked, yes. Which is why I think the Russians would kind of like that. If Putin was sitting there thinking, oh, yes, if there's a tie, it's going to be the best thing ever.
I don't know. I don't know that he wants America really to fall apart.
No, he doesn't want it. But it wouldn't fall apart, though. It would just have a... It would be a bit distracted for a bit.
As it has been.
It would be less interested in helping Ukraine on its eastern border than it currently is.
I don't know. One of the things that can happen with America is that if it gets fractious enough, it might find similar to 2001. In 2000, when Bush was elected, he had the biggest Not My President protests in the history of America up till that point.
Up until Trump.
It was a very nasty election, and there was this constitutional crisis because of the vote counts in Florida. Mm.
There was also the allegations that he had been drunk driving and that kind of thing when he was younger, just before he went.
All kinds of nasty stuff. It was a hugely divisive election.
Yeah.
And then when Bush's kid, George, did become president, he was playing golf. He took the most holiday days in the first year of his presidency because it seemed like he couldn't really do anything because he wasn't smart enough, or because he didn't have the political capital because he'd gone through in the strange way.
Merciless election.
So America was a house divided against itself until the Twin Towers and the Pentagon and that other plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. And then the country united around a common enemy, this sort of
Flight 93.
This idea of terrorism. And if America were to go through a thing like that, like an electoral college tie, it would be even so much worse than the Trump division. Mm. That, look, if there wasn't a war to be had, one would have to be invented. And then Americans would get together around that.
Well, they might finally invade Mexico.
Around a common enemy.
Again, like they did in the 1800s. But All right, well, let's move on to the Mueller report.
Well, I would say just historically, it's really their invasion of Cuba, where they drive out the Spaniards in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, that binds America together after the Civil War.
Yeah.
And ever since then, having a war against a common enemy has been the most effective way to bring Americans together.
But crazy conspiracy theories aside, or crazy predictions, speculations about the future.
The Mueller report got wrecked in the sense that it didn't satisfy anyone.
Yes.
A lot of Democrats were like, ah, oh, he didn't go far enough. A lot of Republicans are like, ah, oh, there was mission creep.
It was a little bit like the ending of Lost.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to talk about now some good news. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, got wrecked.
Yeah, so he released a video earlier in the year saying, reports of my death have been hugely exaggerated. Here I am, loud, proud, and ready to kill all the infidel.
But apparently not. Oops. Well, not anymore.
No.
And he ended up being chased down a tunnel, fleeing with his children, wearing a suicide vest by a dog. He then blew himself up.
Yeah.
And his children, because that was just the sort of charming chap he was. He had a very pretentious name. Those of you who might know something about Islamic history know that the very first successor of Muhammad, the first caliph, was called Abu Bakr.
Although that's only true according to the Sunni and
according
not the
Shia. To the Sunnis and not the Shiites, yes. But if, Abu Bakr is a Sunni.
Yeah.
Anyway, so this was a very pretentious name because his name basically translates as Abu Bakr from Baghdad.
Yeah.
Which is not his birth name, by the way. Actually, it was his pseudonym. His name that he went by in his political career.
Yeah.
He was responsible
like
for
Lady Gaga.
Yes.
Just much worse.
Much worse.
I'm not trying to.
There's not a moral equivalence.
No, that's not the point. Just a name thing.
And of course, we all know that his Islamic State was an incredibly brutal regime which took the most extreme versions of Sharia. Mm. It killed people. It promised it recruited, carried out terrorist attacks in the West. It killed many people in the Middle East and in the West. And it was a terrible, nasty, awful state that managed to get basically every power in the world to fight it. Iran, Russia, and America could all agree, at least on some level. Mm. I mean, there was some collaboration here and there between the Assad regime and ISIS.
There was mess.
But thankfully, ISIS has lost most of its territory or all of it.
Since I was talking about the New York Times, my favorite line from the New York Times in 2019 was when ISIS was militarily taken out.
Yes.
There was a sort of bit of a review, look back on its history. And they noted that at its largest geographic extent, ISIS's area,
yes,
the area of the land that it had command over, was about as large as the little known northwest province of the Republic of South Africa. And I think there was a moment of lucidity that sort of shone through a lot of the ideological noise there, because the northwest province is a very worrying place. It's kind of deserty. It has the most growth in the most economic growth basically in the country because of the platinum group metals that it's sitting on. There's a lot of new money there. There's a lot of social dislocation there. There is some of the most harsh racial divisive language.
It's where the EFF gets a lot of support, actually.
It's a really far out place. And one of the, it's not a place that I'd visited much before this year. Mm. And this year I spent quite a few weeks there.
Now, when you were researching the Kalini case, yeah?
Kalini case, Swazi Reneka case. Yeah, man,
it's got problems.
If one thinks of South Africa falling apart, I think the Northwest Province is the kind of place where, you know, if you can get command of a mine, a lot of the way that sort of inchoate proto-states work in the Middle East is that you manage to get hold of a few oil fields, and that gives you the money generation
to buy arms
that you need to protect the thing and then set up a patronage network to try and grow the thing. And I think, you know, it's one of the reasons that it's important for South Africa to remain a politically coherent rule of law democracy is that if we were to start falling apart, I think the Northwest Province would start remembering why some clever journalist of the New York Times decided to draw that comparison in terms of geographical extent in the first place.
So it's sort of put the cap on the al-Baghdadi story. He's dead.
Yeah.
But ISIS is not, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The recent sort of trouble going on in the Middle East, a lot of ISIS prisoners have escaped from camps where they were being held by the Syrian Democratic Forces, generally referred to as the Kurds. They're not exactly the same thing, but it's, you know, it's a colloquialism. And, you know, he's dead, but we'll see whether anything emerges from the sort of renewed chaos going on in Syria. Hopefully they simply melt away into the desert and we never hear from them again. But we'll have to see. Okay, so moving on from the good news of al-Baghdadi's death is the, well, we've had a lot of arguments about that, about this, whether Theresa May and the destruction of her career was the necessary step for the rise of Boris Johnson and the completion of Brexit, or she was a great failure and a mistake and Boris Johnson should have been the leader all along. This is a debate Gabriel and I have had a lot in the office. We never really reached a conclusion.
Yeah.
We also had our colleague Herman Pretorius, who was on my side, by the way.
The wrong side.
Which is that Theresa May was a failed politician. Whereas Gabriel has very sweetly defended her against these charges.
Yeah, I think she gets the prize for being one of the most noble.
You've cast her as a martyr, a great martyr of British politics in a sense.
Yeah. I mean, my thought about her is that negotiations are very simple in that what you have is a deal that you're trying to propose for two parties to meet. In the simplest version, and there's only three kinds of moves you can make. You can make the deal better for both so that it's more attractive to each, or you can make the best alternative to the negotiated agreement for your opponent worse off. You can say, look, if we don't do this deal, I'm going to punish you very badly, and then they're more likely to join the deal. Or you can make your own best alternative to the negotiated agreement better so that they have to sweeten the deal in order to lure you back into it. So it's just sort of, it's like game theory thing. This is a way of abstracting the three kinds of moves that you can make. But the axes according to which people have values are multifarious. So there's, you know, I can make your BATNA worse, your best alternative to the negotiated agreement worse by saying, if you don't do the deal, we're going to punish you economically. But that might politically satisfy you, because if you're being punished economically, that might get a whole lot of people to feel sympathy for you, and that's going to keep you in office or keep you in popularity or whatever the case may be. So that kind of play makes things complicated. One of the things that Theresa May did right from the beginning was first negotiate how much they were going to settle, how much they were going to pay, basically, the divorce bill to pay to leave the EU, and then only afterwards negotiate other terms thereof. And this frustrated a lot of people who said, look, you've given up a key negotiating stick, the BATNA, how much we pay to leave the EU. This is part of the sort of, well, if you don't, how much do you not pay? Or this is part of the deal. You make it harder for further negotiation to go forward seriously. I think what they underestimated is that by giving up some of the tools for negotiation on the economic front, she gained some tools on the political side. And Europe is a very fractious, very complicated
beast,
unwieldy beast. And it could either have become so divided around this issue that an aggressive Tory line could have driven possibly people like Marine Le Pen into power in a country like France. And mean it could have made the difference. You know, the Austrians nearly had very far right kind of history of fascism kind of party come to power, and instead they didn't. There are a lot of margins where if things had been more aggressive in Europe, you would have had a different political environment to what we see now. And I think part of the reason that the temperature was kept relatively cool was that the Brits came to the negotiating table with a very open heart, with a very open hand, very good faith in very real ways. Look, we're going to sign on to paying the divorce bill first and then figuring out what we're going to do later. I think that strategy played well in terms of the effect that it had on European elections. I think that strategy played well in terms of the effect that it had domestically, where it allowed the Remainers to huff and puff and blow the house down to the point where they just lost their own credibility, because they were blowing against the nicest version of Brexit and still showed themselves to be sort of incalcitrant,
completely against,
nasty, unreasonable. And so by the time they had exhausted themselves, Theresa May could step down and make room in a friendlier Europe, and a more resolved Britain for a charismatic leader.
Also a more with also more fatigued Europe.
Yes, a fatigued and more friendly Europe. Theresa May then made room for a charismatic leader who I think does have the gumption to say, look, if you don't want to do this the nice way, I'm prepared to go the harsh way. And I think in that context, it looks like it'll be easier for Boris to win a real majority and then go to Europe and say, really, we do now have the cards on the table. Let's just do this the nice way, because that's really in our best interests. And I think that'll happen. And then I think that that should be good for the UK's economy. It should be good for the European economy. And I think it's such a divisive issue. If it does get settled in this way, I think people will look back and say how impressive it is that the Brits, they yanna in the parliament, and it seemed kind of like a terrible soap opera, but it was like a soap opera where no one got killed.
The system worked in the end.
I think that people are going to be very impressed at how cool, calm, and collected they were, and Theresa May really was the most cool, calm, and collected of the lot. And I should just add that if I am biased in her favor, it's because she dances in the most charming way to the most charming music. She reminds me of David Bowie.
Indeed she does.
Who is one of the greatest pop stars in the history of the world. And she represents my trajectory in Brexit, where I first thought that if I could have voted on the day, I would have voted to remain in the EU, mostly for geopolitical reasons. I think that the UK is generally a more responsible state and a more powerful state than a lot of Europe. And I think when it's close to Europe, it's historically been good for peace. And so that's why I would have voted that way. But once the referendum had gone the other way,
Something more important was at stake,
and that was the legitimacy of the British government. And so I became a leaver, in a sense. And that's exactly what Theresa May was. She voted to remain, but as soon as the British people had their voices heard with the biggest turnout in any British election in the history of the country, she was like, okay, now we have to implement the will of the British people to the best of our abilities. And I don't, it's not a sexy position to say,
indeed.
I'm not doing this out of a conviction of like what I think is politically or economically
best. Yeah, I'm not passionately rallying the masses behind X, Y, and Z.
I think this is a very important thing to do because I believe in this country, and its institutions and its system.
Well,
anyway,
my read of her is, of course, a little bit different, which is that she was sort of buoyed by her quite big victory in the sort of Tory conference, and this belief that Jeremy Corbyn, who was the Labour opponent, could never win an election. So she believed that she had sort of a free hand. She ran her office dictatorially, at least in the beginning. She tried to keep all the Tory factions happy and didn't choose Leave or Remain, which, as it turns out, seems to have been a choice that all the parties have been forced to make on some level. I don't know how well she negotiated, but I know that at least in managing the domestic affairs in Britain, I don't think she was particularly successful. And most especially, I think the greatest point of failure was the poor election result against Jeremy Corbyn, which put her in a position where her parliamentary majority was weak. It was an election she had called early, specifically so that she could try and get a proper mandate behind herself in Brexit. She campaigned badly, mostly on domestic issues. Brexit wasn't as...
She didn't dance nearly enough.
And as a result, she got stuck with a parliament with this tiny minority.
Yeah, this hung parliament.
This hung parliament. And she suffered her whole career because of that. And she, in the end, just couldn't bridge the divide between all the factions. She couldn't commit the party to one way or the other. She couldn't fight Jeremy Corbyn particularly well, even though he's one of the most unpopular opposition leaders in British history. And this caused her to eventually be forced to resign, despite the fact that Boris Johnson is hated by many people inside the Tory party's upper ranks. He managed to ride her unpopularity to victory. And I think he's done very well since he came in. Although we'll have to see, really. I mean, it's like the apocryphal quote that...
Yes. Very good, from my favorite movie.
From that Trump always uses about...
does he use it?
About the Chinese.
Yeah.
That... they asked, the Chinese leaders were
asked. No, man, Trump doesn't use it. This comes from a movie.
Trump. Trump? France.
Yes, France uses it.
That allegedly the Chinese communist officials were asked, what their opinion on the French Revolution was, and they said something along the lines of
it's too soon to tell.
And I think that's going to be a little bit of the case with Brexit, is we really don't know how the story's going to end.
Yeah.
If they get Brexit and the Corbyn government, it might be a moment of profound devastation
for British politics. Yeah, also if you get Brexit and the Irish peel off and the Scots peel off,
yeah, it would be a nightmare too.
That'd be a nightmare. This is a story that is going to be visible from 100 years' time and still relevant to history, I think, in the year 2100. Yeah. But the point is, something got wrecked, and it was
Theresa May and Theresa May's deal.
Theresa May's deal.
So let's walk on to a little bit of kind of pop culture technology news, which is the world's biggest YouTuber, a guy known as PewDiePie. I think his actual name is Felix.
Oh, no one cares. His name is PewDiePie.
Schorschberg or something like that. He's Swedish. He was the biggest YouTuber for years and years. An individual guy. I think he's got two editors, and that's his entire sort of production company.
Yeah.
He had something like 80 million subscribers.
He plays video games online and talks nonsense.
And now all he does is review memes.
Yeah. It's like hanging out with the sort of weird friend from high school.
Yeah. He was, in a lot of ways, his appeal was that to a lot of younger kids who are maybe a bit socially isolated, he was kind of like a friend.
Yeah. A very close friend.
Who you could hang out with on online.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And who doesn't get too heavy into issues.
He also has done sort of interesting things. He's been under criticism several times because he wants... It's very complicated to explain the context, but basically he said something that was anti-Semitic out of context.
He told a joke, and then he got backlash, and then also, instead of apologizing, he held his line and was like, dude, I'm funny.
Yeah, he also said something racist once, which he did apologize for because he said that it was just...
He was being young and stupid.
No excuse. Yeah. So he's a little bit of a controversial figure, but I think he's genuinely a pretty positive influence. He has it several times encouraged his viewers to read interesting books. He sometimes has a book club kind of section to his show.
He's like Oprah for the youth.
He's a little bit like Oprah for the youth, yeah. In a very weird way. but he had a
Swedish
contest.
Oprah.
He had a contest with a big Indian YouTube channel.
Dots Not Feathers.
Yeah. Called T-Series. And this channel, it's like an aggregator, I think, of it collects all the YouTube pop stars' music videos, and it puts them all on one YouTube channel. And it has been growing massively because, of course, India is a big market that's starting to come online in a very serious way.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a sign of the times, the way that India is sort of rising in the world.
Yeah.
And they had this contest. It became a bit of a meme to get people to follow PewDiePie so that he would stay ahead of T-Series and be the first to 100 million subscribers, which is a huge number of subscribers. That is people who get a notification every time you release a video.
Yeah.
And this went on and on and on, and eventually T-Series passed him somewhere around 95 million subscribers, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Which is quite spectacular.
So India now has the biggest YouTube channel.
Yes, India now has the biggest YouTube channel. He, basically an individual, although him and his two editors, as a sort of small-time YouTuber, he still has the biggest channel by miles.
Yeah.
But there's now a big Indian company which has the biggest YouTube channel on YouTube.
His video, Nick just showed me the video that he made sort of gasp attempt to hold on to his lead. and I don't like swearing, but it's called Bitch Lasagna.
Yes.
And it's pretty hilarious.
It's very weird.
It speaks to the kind of stream of consciousness, loose association. It's like so much of 21st century youth culture is like looking at, it's like a Rorschach test. Look at this piece of paper, kind of what's the first thing that comes to your mind? How do these weird ideas rhyme with each other?
Exactly.
It doesn't, no production value, things like it looks, I feel like the look feel is as much 17-year-olds hanging out in a garage in a lower middle class kind of environment and just goofing around as possible. That's what MTV's music videos were about in the 90s and the 2000s, and that's sort of come online in a YouTube-y way that I think he taps into charmingly.
Yes. The most interesting thing about him is that they asked Generation Z, so that's people born after the year 2000, I think this was in America, they asked them several different personalities, whether you approved of them or not, and whether you knew their name. you'd think that a big basketball player like LeBron James, very well known, had about 99%, I think, name recognition, but only about 52% approval rating. PewDiePie had the same level, 99%
name recognition.
Name recognition and 62% approval rating, which was the highest of anyone in that group.
Yeah.
And I think that shows the big cultural change that's going to come is that these people like YouTube stars are going to become very culturally relevant as generation, as millennials get older and as Generation Z gets older.
And as they get older. So watch out for PewDiePie as a kind of Oprah.
Yeah. No, he might be very big. All right. We're starting to run out of time here, so we'll just breeze past this one quite quickly. I think it's connected to the Ramaphosa thing. Sasol and the JSE.
Oh, God. Wrecked.
Destroyed. Huge capital outflows.
Yeah.
Terrible year for the stock
market. They came back and then they had an AGM yesterday or the day before yesterday. And instead of like talking about the real stuff, the only thing that I heard like on the radio about it afterwards was talking about how dare you sort of be making coal and gas and chemicals and oils and all that kind of stuff in the first place because Greta Thunberg.
Yes. And SAA is also wrecked. And of course, our friend Eskom. Wrecked.
Wrecked.
So then... the big one that I've left till second last, the DA.
DA, wrecked.
Wrecked. This election, terrible election result. We've talked about a lot in the Daily Friend. We talked about a little bit on the Two Crickets and the Thorn Tree. But I put a question mark here because...
Yeah, Phoenix and the Ashes or just Ashes to Ashes.
Yeah, we don't know yet. It remains to be seen. The jury is still out.
As the Chinese wise man say.
Yes.
It is too soon to tell.
Yeah. And the last one, which is one you specifically requested, is Jordan Peterson and Slavoj Žižek had a debate.
Oh, man, they had this debate, and it was like one of the most built-up academic intellectual debates.
It was supposed to be, what, communism versus free markets or something?
Something like that. It's hard to... So Jordan Peterson, you know...
Doesn't like communism.
Doesn't like communism. Slavoj Žižek is sometimes called a communist. He often calls himself a communist. One of his running jokes is... that he speaks a little bit like this from Slovenia. He says, "Are you, when the revolution comes, you are good, you will go to jail because you are a capitalist, but on Sundays when everyone gets soup, you will get two bowls of soup." That's what he says when a capitalist makes a really good point. That's like the highest compliment he can pay. But when they had the debate, so much of it was really lucid, I thought, and one of the points that quickly emerged is that they struggle to disagree with each other because the left-right divide is so orthogonal to, I think, what pulls a lot of people. I mean, including them. Jordan Peterson is so happy to have, like, a national healthcare system, for example.
Yeah, and well, he's Canadian.
And Slavoj Žižek is so happy to have, like, a very limited government. The left-right divide is an economic divide about whether you want a slightly bigger government or a slightly smaller government is really irrelevant on an international scale because the size of governments on the international scale varies from Ireland, which is 12% income tax, to Sweden, which is sort of 70% income tax. And both countries run each other themselves quite well.
Yeah.
And there are other countries that have similarly big or small governments that really run each other badly. So that left-right divide is really... not clever. And Slavoj Žižek, because he grew up under a communist regime, knows how stupid it is and really doesn't want communism. His idea of communism is to go into leftist rallying points and say, sometimes the most radical thing to do is nothing at all. And it's quite sexy. It's quite a sexy idea that just doing nothing is actually the most radical thing you can do. And it sort of deflates a lot of the... He's like, maybe we should sit and talk about it. This is really a great idea. Like, if I could do that every now and then, if he could have been in South African university campuses in the 2015 fallist moments, I think, with his, you know, it'll really be radical, not protesting. Then that might have changed the country's direction a little bit. Anyway, the point is, they both wrecked each other because they struggled so hard to find points that they disagree on.
I think they probably would have stoned him to death on the Fallist campus.
Oh, right.
They weren't exactly in an open-minded mood.
No.
But anyway, I think that concludes our episode. We've actually managed to keep it to 1 hour and 3 minutes, according to my clock here. So thank you, everyone, for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this little kind of sort of roundup of the year of things that have been destroyed.
Yeah.
If you like the work the IR does.
After the ad, bad, in with the good.
Yeah, yeah.
SMS 3 to 823. That'll bring more goodness to you and the world.
You'll pay our salaries, which will allow us to continue to produce long hour-long podcasts like this. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode of Two Crickets in a Thorn Tree.